We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Listen to every MLB game live.
In the deep left center field, it is high, it is far, it is gone.
Stream minor league affiliates.
The Midwest League home run leader.
And watch the best baseball highlights and look-ins on MLB Big Inning. MLB At Bat is your all-in-one live baseball subscription for only $3.99 per month.
Deep left field, it's gonna go! Alvarez ties the game!
Subscribe to At Bat within the MLB app today. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Hello and welcome to Better Living, a show about the people and organizations that make an impact in our area. I'm your host, Nick Carissimi. A returning guest and a brand new group on today's show. Coming up later in the program, Maricela Arce with the Texas Tuition Promise Fund joins me in studio to talk about this excellent program that helps families and students save a lot of money on college tuition. We're going to start things off with the Texas Muslim Women's Foundation. Monica Feel is their chief philanthropy and operating officer. How are you today?
Hi, how are you, Nick? Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for joining me today. Aaliyah Henry, friend of the show, recommended you for an interview. Got you in as fast as I could. Luckily, here you are. Let's talk about this organization and what you guys do.
Yes, this organization is very dear to my heart. I've been with this organization for past 12 or 13 years, so I'm kind of a dinosaur in that agency. So any historic information, please come. You don't need to dig archives. I'm there for you.
You are the living archive
exactly.
of the organization.
Yes, yes. But I've moved from a volunteer to board member to the staff, so it has been a great learning journey for me personally, as well as growing of the organization. So it was established in 2005, and by 2008 we were looking at part-time people working for us, and then 2010 we were hiring full-time. Fast forward, this year is our 15th year anniversary, and we are sitting at 40 plus employees full-time and part-time. So we
really
mushroomed like nobody's
business.
That's
crazy.
Yes.
That's a lot bigger than I would have guessed.
Right.
You were with the organization almost from the beginning. Very
exactly.
early, let's
you know,
say.
When they say that I wasn't part of the founding members, but I rushed as soon as I heard. So yes.
What brought you to the organization initially?
The mission always spoke to me, because the mission is empowering women. And I think when you empower women in whatever way, whether, you know, you teach them a few things or you do intervention services, you empower a woman, it means you're empowering the family and then community. So that part is very important, that woman has to have decision-making powers. No matter what her arena of decision-making is, let her learn those skills. So that, to me, has been very important in my life, as well as the mission of Texas Muslim Women's Foundation. So that brought me in.
How did you initially find out about it?
Believe it or not, it was Google search. And it was because I was looking for an organization for my daughter to volunteer in. She was in elementary school at that time. And I wanted her to see an organization which was not too much heavy on faith-based, but serving everyone. Because faith tells you to serve whoever is there. So to me, and when I saw their mission, it really spoke to me. So first thing was, you know what, I want my daughter to volunteer. And while I'm sitting in the car, let me volunteer also. And then the rest is history.
It's interesting that you already brought it up. We were going to get to it. One of the things that you mentioned to me off air was that this is not an organization for just Muslim women. This is an organization for anybody that needs help. That's the root mission, I would say, of this organization.
Absolutely. And that is one of the reasons why I am still here. It's basically, I love the fact that when the founding members created this organization, they said, well, we have issues like domestic violence or youth leadership or what have you, but these are across the board. So it's not just Muslim women. So we want to show that Muslim women are so strong and powerful that we can make a change, but it is for everyone. That for me was very important. They looked at Catholic charities. Right. That was a prime example of, you know, you are guided by your faith, but then it is not restricted to only one faith.
That's what I have found with a lot of the organizations that I interview. There is a religious component somewhere in there.
Right.
But even in half hour long conversations, it really doesn't come up much at all. And it's something that I like. You're using your faith to complete a mission of some sort.
Absolutely.
And that's really what you're doing. That's the focus. And I think that that's maybe religion at its best.
Correct. And then you also have to realize, in especially in the arena of domestic violence, faith, any faith, is misused. The context is misused for by the abusers. So it can be Muslims or Christians or whoever, you name it. The sacred text is always misused by abusers. So you have to tackle it partly from faith perspective anyway, because that is what some of the abusers are using.
What is your background? Have you worked with nonprofits or charities in the past?
Before this, yes, a little bit of volunteering with a lot of nonprofit back home also, as well as in Texas. So there's another organization called Texas Interfaith. So I worked with them as well as, you know, managing their program and serving the underserved population. So I worked with them as well.
Would you say it's been a part of your family? Is this a family endeavor?
Definitely. Definitely. Because, you know, anytime I can pull my kids and, of course, my husband, they've been voluntold many times that they've forgotten the count. But yes, and in fact, I'll tell you an insider joke. My husband wouldn't change the car because I had that truck, and he would be like, "You're hauling one, you know, donations from another organization. Why would I buy you a new car?" So for the longest, I was carrying an old truck.
I mean, he does kind of have a point, but then I can also see it from your side, too.
Yes.
I think that does make sense. Where did you, you haven't mentioned it yet, where are you from, and what did you do first in your first charitable endeavor?
First charitable endeavor. I think that was, we have learned, again, I guess part of our faith and our family ethics that, you know, you have, if you're living a life and you are blessed in any way, you have to serve. There is no life if you don't serve. So that part has always been, you know, growing up and in parenting. And philanthropy was not so organized in our parents' generation. It used to be somebody's coming, they're needy. Okay, hand them money, go. You'll do it. So it was not as organized as it is right now. So I think that was a childhood thing that I've learned, that whoever is coming for help, you help them. So it's right now it has moved more into strategy.
It's more streamlined.
Exactly.
Are you a very organized personality? Do you like order?
I may take a fifth on that, but yes.
That's a yes. That's absolutely a yes.
Yes.
I love talking to people that start out in an organization volunteering, or maybe they were partaking in the services, and then they move through that organization. I think it gives them the best understanding that you could have of an organization, and it turns you into a better leader. So you started with your daughter volunteering here at the organization. When did you decide that you needed to be more involved?
I think it was starting off because when I joined, at that time, it was a all-volunteer-run organization. And the dream was, okay, let's have a first shelter. And that needed a lot of business behind it, working on the business module and how to grow. I'm a very process-oriented person. So for me, process is very important. So I bought into the bigger dream of, yes, we need a shelter. Yes, we need fundraising. So how do we create structures around it? Because, you know, nonprofits do start. And if they don't grow with the structure, then after there is no growth after a certain level.
Right.
So that was part of my work, and I love organizing things. So I have always been working in the background, making sure the systems are okay, the systems are running, how the growth is projected. So that has been my expertise, and I love doing that.
Yeah.
So when the shelter conversation started to happen, it was a very it was not an easy thing. especially within our community, and I would say all faith-based communities, but I'm talking about 10 years ago, when you would go to a faith leader and you would ask them that, you know, okay, here's my flyer. This is about domestic violence. So, you know, if somebody's coming into a mosque or a church, please have these flyers ready. And we would hear that, nope, domestic violence doesn't exist in our community. Why would we air dirty laundry outside? This is not on. You guys are breaking families.
Mm.
And we chipped at it. We kept on. So our focus was educate people first.
Was that an expected reaction, or did that reaction bolster you and make you want to work harder for this organization?
Absolutely. It was, you know, education is the key. No matter which topic you take, right? Anything that people are not expecting, it is happening. There's no denying. The numbers show. Numbers have stories. So it is happening. So it is just about education and connecting the dots for a lot of people. And believe it or not, we chipped at it for a number of years. And fast forward, and 15 years now, we have almost all of the mosques, major mosques in DFW, working with us. They do Friday sermon for us. And anytime they have signed a zero tolerance in their mosque if somebody goes through domestic violence. So we've come a long way. We really have come.
I'm sure it's a long answer, but what, in your opinion, was the change?
I would say a couple of things, and I'll try to shorten it. One is education, for sure. And then we did not make this about women's issue. This is a family affair. This is a family issue. That spoke to a lot of people.
The message became, we're not helping women, we're helping families.
There you go. Yes.
And that's really what took.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. What is your professional background? You said that you like to organize things and get things moving together. What do you do professionally? Or what is your background, at least?
It was business development.
Business
development. Yeah.
So
funny.
Literally what we're talking about, the exact thing.
Right.
I like it when it's just a straight line. There's no meandering. It's just,
no,
boom,
life
this is what
simple.
I do. There you go. Life is simple. Like we said, from volunteer to part-time employee, what did you start doing when you became an actual employee of the organization? Where did you start your focus?
I think I was hired at the time where we were getting our first grant. So we have been partnering with other foundations locally. And one of our greatest cheerleader has been Texas Women's Foundation, previously known as Dallas Women's Foundation.
Yeah.
They have been our cheerleaders since day one. And they really helped us go to another level. So, you know, in 2008 and 9, along those times, they said, why don't you apply for a certain grant? And that was a Robert Wood Johnson grant, which is a nationwide. And they were investing in Texas. And they wanted to work on a bigger model, because Robert Wood Johnson is a healthcare foundation. And they treated mental health or domestic violence as a health care issue. So that was their angle. And they spoke with Texas Women's Foundation, and they said, well, why don't you guys apply for this? And we were like, how do you spell grant? What do you do? And they walked us every step of the way. They supported us. They were our connection with Robert Wood Johnson. So when that came in, that was the time when we hired our first three employees, and I was one of the three.
Okay.
That meant more work and actively working on the shelter. So I think that gave us focus, and that gave us, you know, okay, now this is not just mom and pop. We are not newbies. We are moving into staffing positions. So I think that gave us a new breath.
I normally like to ask organizations when the explosion happened. It's obviously happened, you know, for you guys, and that's what you're saying. That's when it happened.
Correct.
The responsibility that you're talking about, that you guys immediately felt, all
yes.
three employees of you.
Right.
Some people do not like that feeling. Other people thrive on that feeling. Is that, sure. Would you describe the organization in that way, really taking that responsibility and saying, it's on our shoulders now? We have no choice but to move forward, and hard.
Absolutely. Because, see, the founders or the founding members were basing their causes on community feedback. So this was formed after 9/11, where the community was screaming that, you know, okay, we need shelter. We need our youth to be in the leadership positions or leadership roles. So this was a community-based, and it still is community-based. Mm. We rely very, very heavily on feedbacks. we rely very heavy on where the need is. We're going into now maybe refugee program because that seems to be the need. So we have been expanding and we have been growing, not because there are few people in the room, the leadership, they decide what the direction should be, but it is reverse, what the community needs, and then we are servants, we provide.
You are responding to what people
exactly.
need.
Exactly.
Did the organization start as a women's shelter? I was looking at the website, which once again is tmwf.org. You provide a lot of different services, and we will discuss that. I want to figure out exactly what you guys are doing. But it seems like it started with a shelter, and then, through listening to the community, you expanded. Is that roughly
Well,
how it
kind
works?
Of. Because so when the founders, they were sitting and they realized that, you know, after 9/11, where is our identity? Because whatever is being shown on TV or social media, that is not our identity. And that is not our religion, what we practice. So that became the conversational conversation with the founders. And then they went around in the community asking, what are our needs? What are we going through? So domestic violence became, social services became first priority. A lot of women were not going to the mainstream shelters because the lack of language, culture understanding. So they were going back to their abusers. So reporting was not being done. Second was the youth, because they were so bullied and traumatized, other people bullying them, oh, you're a Muslim, you know, you are terrorist. So that part was hurting the community. So there were a lot of issues. And then the third was senior citizens. Where do they fit in into this entire role of post 9/11? So this is a post 9/11 conversation, and the founders sat down in detail and had these kind of need informal need assessment. And social service became a priority organically. So we set aside, okay, let's first establish shelter. Let's set aside social services first. Then came youth leadership. Then we probably will be working on seniors. So all these are part of, initial thought. But, you know, we have to tackle one step at a time. We have to go one step at a time. And speaking of growth, right now we have 2 shelters. And we have 27 transitional apartments. So from 2000, and our first shelter opened in 2012. So from 2012 to 2020, this is where we are.
Small amount of growth. Just barely just moving the needle.
Exactly. I hardly work.
Does the organization still have to work on, let's say, misunderstandings about the community? Is that something that the organization still focuses on? Or are you guys able to focus more on your stated mission?
Both. Yes, both. Because, again, we are so service-driven that we don't have any marketing budgets. So whoever comes to us, we beg them and we say, please, okay, interview, yes, like you, no matter what it takes, we will talk. So it's kind of a reverse thing. We do not have the time or the bandwidth to reach out and work on the marketing side of things. We go and we do a lot of talks in churches. We do a lot of conversations in mosques with law enforcement. We train law enforcement, so we do that, but it's mostly invitation only, because like I said, every day we're all down in the weeds working on the work. So that's where we are at. So
Monica Feel is the chief philanthropy and operating officer of the Texas Muslim Women's Foundation. You can find them online at tmwf.org. Let's talk about the services that you provide.
Yes.
Because there are a lot of them. I'll ask you just to start off where you would like. What is the first program and or service that you feel like talking about?
Absolutely. The 2 shelters. Social services. That is our prime program. And in social services, we have prevention and we have intervention. So we go out and, for example, this radio show, other radio shows, other workshops with law enforcement, that is all on prevention side. Because intervention can happen at a certain level, but we have to focus on prevention. Prevention is the single most important thing for us as well. So, and then on intervention side, we have like I said, two shelters. We can house up to 24 plus women. These are emergency shelters. They come through our hotline. They come through police, law enforcement, and community members. So that's the two shelters. Then after that shelter, these ladies move into transitional housing, which is, you know, 18 months, 3 months of housing relief that they get before they go on to their own homes, apartments, wherever they are, you know, established. So these are the two steps for our clients to move in. Now, during that time, the minute a client comes in, we have one person designated to one client, which is a case manager. Case manager becomes their best friend. All resources are coming through the case manager. That client may need counseling or play therapy. We have counselors and play therapy. That client may need immigration or family attorney. We have two of them at our at the organization. So these are some of the services, like a very overarching umbrella services. The case manager is the key to this because they will find resources for you. They will do ESL classes for you. They will look for work. They will do your prepare you for job interview.
Resumes.
Finding resources. Because a lot of these women, when they come into the shelter, they may have just not even a bag on their shoulder. So from day one, what do you need? So they are the ones filling in everything that the client needs. And few things. See, along the road, we realized what are some key issues when women go through domestic violence. So one of the key that is coming up is economic independence, financial literacy. A lot of women will not leave the abuser because of, you know, not knowing what a bank account should look like. So our programs are now being centered with the programs like financial literacy. We are starting one-on-one individual counseling and explaining what does a budget look like. What is checking versus saving? What is 1099 versus W-2? Simple things, very simple things. So that is case management. We call that a case management. And then once they go through counseling, so what happens is even after transitional housing, let's say they've moved into their own home, but they still need counseling, we will work with them. They need a lot of times, you know, the attorneys, and they take longer time for the paperwork to fill in. So the clients will work with them even when they leave the shelter. So our purpose is by the time they come in, we work on their trauma. Because we're a trauma-informed agency. We work on their trauma and then slowly rehabilitate them to wherever they want to go and make sure that they are able, they're, you know, they're on their feet, alone, children, wherever. So they pick, they do their own benchmarking. They create their own roadmap. We are there to gently help them in whatever way we can.
You mentioned ESL classes, also a refugee program.
Yes.
Are there certain areas of the world or countries that you guys are seeing a lot of clients from? I'm not sure, honestly, about the Muslim community in Dallas and what the makeup is. What are you guys seeing? Of course, the organization helps anyone.
Right.
But within that, is there anything that stands out, let's say?
I'll tell you, I would still say we still are under the rock. We are not out in the community. But we are really well embedded within the law enforcement and other shelters.
Okay.
They are well aware of our services. Now, when we speak about our services, one thing that I would want to point out is when we say we're trauma-informed, in our office, we have 15-plus languages spoken at our office. So with a staff of 40 members, you know, on average, people speak two languages. That's very common. Now, what happens time and again, what we've realized that when somebody who goes through trauma, they, if they speak in their own language, and if they're sitting across somebody who they think understands the culture, the trauma of those events or series of events or whatever they've gone through, the recovery is faster.
I think that makes sense. If I had to explain to someone in a language that wasn't my first language something traumatic, it would be extremely difficult.
Right.
And it would be very frustrating. And I could see you clamming up. And you wouldn't want to maybe express it. It would just make a difficult situation even more difficult.
Right. And add a layer of external trauma of, yes, these are stereotyping of Muslims. So add that, add another trauma to that. So multiple layers of trauma. Now, in terms of where, we do not ask people about their race or religion because we are non-denominational. We do not discriminate. So, we don't have any numbers of, we are getting certain nationalities or certain, cultures that are coming forward. It's everyone at this point. We actually had a decline of hotline numbers in 2016 because of what happened. So whatever happens politically, nationwide, Texas-wide, we are affected. But because there is a trickle-down effect. So in 2016, right after elections, our hotlines dropped because the abusers were threatening a lot of survivors, a lot of victims about, we'll call ISIS on you. We will call police on you. They were not reporting. They were not going out. So that had a serious effect on our clients. They were not coming out.
Did you notice that real time? Did you see it as it was happening?
Yes, because we have a lot of grants. We report. We do, every month we have numbers that show us. And that has been because we went informally around in the community asking what has happened, why. So the informal conversations brought us that conversation.
Another thing that you are able to get from the community, not only programs and services provided, literally what's happening to them and where they live, and then you're able to adjust the organization through that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, we, a lot of times, the legal help that, that we work with, that changes on what is the current situation nationally and locally. So services change. And we have to be cognizant of, what is happening in a broader picture at any given time.
Let's talk about volunteers and what the organization needs. You do have a staff, but I have to imagine that you guys rely heavily on volunteers. If people want to be a part of this organization, that capacity, what do you need? What could people do for the organization?
What I need is a couple of $1 million.
If anybody just wants to volunteer those.
That's welcome. So, any time we are always looking for volunteers, and we are at a stage where we need more specialized volunteers, meaning that, somebody who has an expertise in human resources, somebody who has finance background. So those kind of volunteers are really appreciated. And then at the same time, like I said, we have a refugee empowerment program also. So we have teachers, we have some people who can give us English, as we have a curriculum, they can come in. So what happens is that you teach ESL, but that means nothing to them. But what the difference or the tipping point for us is, we give them simple living resources. If you go to an apartment, this is how a contract should look like. Let's read English on that. Let's read English. Here's your 1099. So we don't call it exactly ESL, but again, it is teaching them.
I really like how focused the organization seems to be on essentials.
Yes.
Let's get a resume going. Let's get you in a job. Let's get you figured out on taxes, on bank statements.
Absolutely.
It's not just random things that might help a person. Mm-hmm. It is the most important things to do to establish a human being as an individual or a family, to get somebody on their feet and fast. That really seems to be the focus.
Absolutely. You have to believe in human dignity. And with this population, that's the first thing that abusers would take. No dignity. There are a lot of clients who come through our shelter. They cannot even imagine what their next meal is going to be like. So giving them simple tools, what we do at our shelter is every Friday, the house manager would sit with the clients and ask them, what would you like to have? Can you create menu? So simple things or simple decision making, we start at that level where they started, one fine day they're in the shelter and they have to decide for their own self which is something that has been taken away from them. So simple, small steps, that's human dignity.
The organization is the Texas Muslim Women's Foundation. You guys have an event happening on March 5th, which is International Women's Day. It's a luncheon celebrating that. It starts at 11:30, goes till 1 p.m. over at the Prestonwood Country Club. If you want details, find it on their Facebook page or, of course, on the website tmwf.org. Unbelievably, we have already blasted through half an hour. I don't think that we've talked enough, so I will invite you to come back again. I'd love to have you back in. Monica Feel is the Chief Philanthropy and Operating Officer for the Texas Muslim Women's Foundation. One more time, their website, tmwf.org, and their phone numbers, the 24/7 Family Violence Hotline, 972-880-4192. If you want to reach them at the main office, 469-467-6241. Thank you very much for your time today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me over.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.